The first reading this morning comes from an essay called "Come, Ye Disconsolate," which is a quotation from an old Methodist hymn. The essay, however, is by Taquina Boston, a Unitarian Universalist from All Souls Church in Washington, D.C.
At St. Paul African Methodist Episcopal Church in Washington, D.C., where I grew up, ministers asserted that neither material assets, nor profession, nor social standing determined intrinsic worth. As much as the St. Paul community formed my understanding, the most influential minister of my childhood and early youth was a Baptist minister from Georgia. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke to the brokenness and suffering caused by injustice in society. King's ministry underscored religious teachings that the core of faith was not what people believed, but how they lived their values. Religious people face a difficult challenge, not choosing between compassion and justice, but learning how the two can operate together. When I discovered Unitarian Universalism a decade later, as a young adult at the All Souls Church in Washington, D.C., I found a faith with justice at its core. I did not leave St. Paul Church because I rejected anything. I joined All Souls because Unitarian Universalism was theologically expansive, emphasized human agency, and brought together faith and justice.
The second reading comes from a book that I've quoted before and will quote again, Samir Slamanovich's remarkable "It's Really All About God: Reflections of a Muslim, Atheist, Jewish Christian."
To the very end of his life, Sigmund Freud was an uncompromising atheist, describing belief in God as a collective neurosis. But in his last book, Moses and Monotheism, he recognized that the poetry and promise of religion exist along with its shadows. He argued that pure and undiluted faith in one God — Freud singled out Judaism as its only authentic expression — instead of being the so-called opiate of the people, helped free humanity from bondage to the immediate empirical world, opened up fresh and renewed possibilities for the human spirit and practice. What matters here is that we acknowledge both the good and the bad, the light and the shadow, in the other, and seek a way of being together in the world. Greg Epstein, a friend and humanist chaplain at Harvard University, who wrote the book titled Good Without God, said, "If people take only one thing from my work, let it be that an authentic, passionate, committed atheist must accept the dignity of other beliefs." Some atheists want to erase religion, the way some fundamentalists want to erase humanism. My humanism is an embracing philosophy. It says, let's know ourselves enough to know why we disagree, and then let's trust ourselves to care about each other and work together toward common goals. Faith imagines, and so does doubt. We have both, and we are better together.
Thank you.
If you were to ask me when I first identified as a Unitarian Universalist, I'd officially have to tell you it was when I chose to sign the membership book at the Universalist Unitarian Church of Farmington, Michigan, back in 1973. I was in my early 20s. I went to services for 6 months before I signed the book. After all, I wanted my commitment to be a commitment, not some flash-in-the-pan impulsivity. But really, that's just an institutional date. I think my spiritual identity as a Unitarian Universalist could just as well be said to have commenced when I realized that I deeply loved my mother's parents, my grandparents, equally. I loved my atheist grandfather. I loved my devout Catholic grandmother. My grandfather, as I pointed out before, had no use for religion of any kind, not any of it. And my grandmother's religion, which was the same as my own in those days, showed little respect for atheists. But when I was 11 years old, I realized that a relationship of love didn't mean a relationship of identical beliefs or identical skepticism. It was not a security blanket where people have their own beliefs applauded and insured. Of course, I had never heard the words Unitarian Universalist in those days, back when I was 11. But spiritually, I would have to say that that's when I officially crossed the boundary into my present territory. Did my grandparents always get along in their decades-long marriage? Of course not. Who does? Once my grandmother threatened my grandfather when she was mad at him about something. Who remembers what? She said to him, "You just wait, Albert. If you die before me, I won't have you cremated like you want. I'll have you put into a coffin and laid into a mausoleum next to me. You'll see." But despite the inevitable conflicts, they had a good, reliable marriage of many decades, even surviving the horrible days generated by the death of their child, my mother's sister. Their relationship was strong. They had many friends who visited them from all over the world. And my grandmother daily translated my grandfather's remarkable garden produce into the best food anyone in this room could possibly imagine. My grandparents believed different things about the meaning of life and the world, but they reconciled their differences by giving up expectations. Expectations that the other person would or should simply give up their worldview for the sake of the relationship. Or expectations that sharing a spiritual stance was necessary to a healthy relationship. Or expectations that love requires a shared identity between lovers, with someone giving up his or her inferior identity to the superior one. Neither my grandfather nor my grandmother was a Unitarian Universalist, but they taught the basic course, even if they didn't know it. And of course, I've come to realize that what my grandparents unwittingly taught me about my present religious status is true even beyond the whole notion of religious identity. My friend Alec, for example, is a strikingly beautiful man whose mother comes out of Kentucky and whose father was born in the Caribbean. According to the stubborn and foolish practice of racialization in the United States, Alec's beige-skinned parent is called a white woman. His mahogany-skinned parent is called a black man. What does that make Alec? Is he supposed to choose one as the right identity, one the wrong identity? Is he supposed to love one part of himself more than the other? It makes my head hurt to know that there are folks who actually think things like that. And they do. The Cherokee story we told to our children this morning moved me when I first read it. It's simple, but right on. It speaks of two people in relationship who have expectations of each other. A lot like my grandparents, in fact. The man expects his wife to do what she loves doing, namely, cooking. He's hungry. He expects supper on the table. The woman expects to delight her husband, whom she loves, with flowers she has picked. She wants to please him with beauty. He doesn't get it. So their expectations are not met. They get angry at each other and they separate. Once, however, the son forces them to stop and taste the sweetness of life right there in front of them. The sweetness of life and love they forfeited by worshiping their expectations instead of each other. They reconcile. That means that they live with more back and forth communication, more questions, fewer expectations, thereby discovering real happiness. Over the years, I found that I've had to reconcile myself to others who do not believe the way I do, or who don't use language like I do, or who try to convince me that they are right and I am wrong, and that I should either stop using certain words or at least start using theirs. On the other hand, over the years, there have been times when I thought I was right and other people were wrong. Now let me clarify what I'm saying. I'm not talking here about reconciling to people who shout at me that I'm going to burn in hell forever for not agreeing with their understanding of Christ. When that happens, I simply walk away. Since there's no question of having any possible conversation, but only of saving myself from verbal violence. I'm not talking about reconciling myself to the political innuendos and broadsides of pundits like Rush Limbaugh or Patrick Buchanan or Rick Santorum or Michelle Bachmann. Again, until I find really hard evidence that we share a certain amount of goodwill to even begin a conversation about our differences, I really don't see the point. I simply have to protect my soul from innuendos and broadsides and not enter into the fray. But, like Samir Samanovich, I freely do have deep conversations with people who assert different things than I do. I have atheist, Jewish, Muslim, Catholic, and Methodist friends, Mennonite friends, that I've talked with just this week alone, talked deeply with. Samir Samanovich is himself a Seventh-day Adventist pastor. I'm not. But he lives in a community, which he formed, in Manhattan with Muslims, Jews, Catholics, Buddhists, humanists, atheists, and so forth. And the conversation between them is all civil and deep and transformative and compassionate and beautiful. Note, the Muslims do not turn from the Quran after these conversations with their friends. The Catholics do not become atheists after talking with the atheists any more than my grandmother became an atheist in relationship to my grandfather, or my grandfather started to attend Mass because he was married to my grandmother. The non-religious folk at this house of Samir Simanovich do not prate on and on that one day everyone will just grow up and give up childish myths and everyone will live without God talk and we'll all be free. Samir himself does not hold out with bated breath for the conversion of humanist Greg Epstein to Christ, the Christ he himself worships as a Seventh-day Adventist pastor. Identities are maintained, but hearts are open and kind. This interfaith community in Manhattan, which I have mentioned before and will mention again, is a sign of great hope for me in this divisive era. Identities are distinct, self-defined, and self-expressed, and Samir's faith is untarnished because of criticism from the outside. Samir's Christian denomination, for example, in the past, has featured theologians who have officially identified the Pope in Rome as the Antichrist, and his worldwide flock of billions as apostates. Yet Samir engages actual Catholics, not twisted portraits of them rooted in 19th century American anti-immigration polemics from the Know Nothing Party. And that's where anti-Catholicism comes from. He meets people heart to heart. He meets human beings, real human beings, human to human, him being a human being as well. He does not meet culture to culture, theology to theology. The Muslims and Jews in this New York community fast on Yom Kippur or Ramadan, whenever that happens during the year, but they also fast from antagonisms that many critics just assume must be there. They're Muslims and Jews, after all. The atheists and the humanists in the community articulate the same excellent attitude of Greg Epstein, the humanist chaplain at Harvard, whom Samir quotes. Here's the quote. "If people take only one thing from my work, let it be that an authentic, passionate, committed atheist must accept the dignity of other beliefs. Some atheists want to erase religion the way some fundamentalists want to erase humanism. My humanism is an embracing philosophy. It says, let's know ourselves enough to know why we disagree, and then let's trust ourselves to care about each other and work together toward common goals." Exactly. Samir correctly points out Sigmund Freud's own religious journey. An atheist throughout his life, Samir agrees, but toward the end, as he writes his last text, Moses and Monotheism, Freud is able to articulate that the use of God language has the power to, quote, help free humanity from bondage to the immediate empirical world and open up fresh and renewed possibilities for the human spirit and practice. Samir seems to be pointing out, as I read him, that we all have the opportunity to grow deeper, to learn to see that those with whom we do not share spiritual vocabulary might be living their lives in exactly the way we imagine we are living our lives, with fresh possibilities, visions of freedom and hope, and open, compassionate hearts. In other words, the folks at the Interfaith Center in Manhattan have blessed the idea of spiritual journeys and have given up the privilege of being right. That's right, the privilege of being right. They're not worried that they are wrong, mind you. They have simply given up the whole notion that the world can be divided neatly, once and for all, by them into absolute right and wrong. Someone may say to me, but that's not the way Seventh-day Adventists really act. I used to be one, I know. They don't make nice with Catholics or those Muslims. Samir is not a real Seventh-day Adventist. Well, no, his experience and someone else's experience may be different, but that does not make one more right than the other. Sandy Aska of this congregation sent me a wonderful article this week exploring the idea of whether American Buddhists have distorted the original Asian forms of that august religious practice. It's a good article. Owen Flanagan, the author, writes, "Last month, when my new book was published, I was deep in the jungle among the Achuar, an indigenous people living on 2 million acres of primary rainforest in southeastern Ecuador and northeastern Peru. The Achuar had not been contacted until the 1970s, and they are, despite the thirst for oil on their lands, committed to living harmoniously and sustainably with nature. The Achuar say to everyone that they're Catholic, but there are no churches. There are numerous shamans. The Achuar interpret their dreams every morning in order to plan their days. They shape shift, they tell me. They use hallucinogens to see their future. And many men have multiple wives. I was raised as a Catholic, so I was amused and perplexed," he writes, "by this odd and ill-fitting appendage to a noble form of life. In what sense of Catholic are the Achuar people Catholic? Are they Catholics primarily because they have learned to say that the spirit of the rainforest, Arutum, is the spirit of Jesus Christ?" The question generalizes. What beliefs or practices are enough to make one a bona fide member of any spiritual tradition? This is a good question, I suppose. But if the spiritual life may be seen as a journey, as Samir suggests, where we change and deepen and reinterpret, relinquish and claim various vocabularies, then in what sense can the word bona fide have any ultimate meaning? It may make some people uncomfortable that the world of definitions amongst the human race is so fluid. But that discomfort is neither a critique nor an expression of philosophy or theology. Tekina Boston grew up in a church, an African Methodist Episcopal congregation, where she says the ministers asserted that neither material assets nor profession, nor social standing determined our intrinsic worth as human beings. Makes sense to me. She says that she gathered later on more wisdom on her spiritual journey from Dr. King, a Georgia Baptist. She writes, "King's ministry underscored religious teachings that the core of faith was not what people believed, but how they lived their values." Then Tekina Boston describes her next lap on her journey with beautiful clarity. "When I discovered Unitarian Universalism a decade later as a young adult at All Souls Church in Washington, D.C., I found a faith with justice at its core. I did not leave St. Paul Church because I rejected anything. I joined All Souls because Unitarian Universalism was theologically expansive, emphasized human agency, and brought together faith and justice. As I said, I discovered Unitarian Universalism as a younger adult myself. My journey was different than Takina's, but it was and still is a journey. I have wrestled with words, issues, and affirmations like Unitarians and Universalists have done for centuries. And even though I have changed my mind many times, shifted in my heart closer to this or that, I've always self-defined as a Unitarian Universalist, even though I've stressed different parts of our living tradition at different parts of my life. Now, over the years, I have heard voices who, I guess, have a very difficult time adjusting to the distinct vocabularies in use amongst Unitarian Universalists. Some wince when Takina Boston uses the word faith. For them, faith means belief in a series of religious assertions that are shared. I believe that such and such and such are true. For me, faith does not mean that. For me, it's a perfectly fine way of talking about our religious culture, where we proclaim that we have confidence, trust, that is, faith, that it's even possible for people of different theologies to make community together and work on justice issues together. For me, faith does not mean belief, and belief does not mean faith unless I say, I believe in you. I'm not saying I believe that you exist. I'm saying I believe in you, and that's a little closer to my understanding of the word faith. It's a little loose. But I am still a Unitarian Universalist in good standing, as is the person who is uncomfortable with the word faith and feels that that word is the very antonym or opposite word of the scientific worldview. But there can be no final convincing arguments one way or the other to get us all to agree on the meaning of several significant words like God or faith or save, or soul, or even shared meanings of justice. But agreement on the personal nuances that words hold for us is not the point, any more than my grandparents needed to agree about God in order to enter the relationship of love and good, solid marriage, or any more than my friend Alec needs to give up half his heritage to be a whole person. It's just absurd to say so. To want to be right, or to think that being right is the point of any religious assertion, is to give up the possibility of community freely entered, freely made. To want to be right is to imagine that community can only be put together by external force and submission to some universal authority, and that universal authority is usually, unfortunately, embodied in the person who claims to be right. To be a Unitarian Universalist is to give up claims of being right, of being subject to a creed, even if that creed is a skeptical creed. It makes no sense, for example, to define Unitarian Universalists, and I have heard this said over the years, as a bunch of agnostics who just can't kick the religion habit. Such a definition does not include me, and I cannot be written out of the meeting by anyone who makes universal claims like that. Perhaps whoever says that wants to be right and assumes that there can only be one honest philosophy, namely their own, but that does not describe Unitarian Universalism. Oh, there's all kinds of interesting identities out there, religious identities, wild, self-claimed identities that are not Unitarian Universalist. There's one guy I know of, Robert Price, who has written a series of books trying to prove, a futile task all my study has convinced me, that Jesus of Nazareth never even existed and was made up by fabled mythologists. It's an old and, to my mind, completely discredited assertion. But what's interesting is that even though he doesn't believe Jesus ever existed, he goes to a Christian church every Sunday and receives the Eucharist, that is, Holy Communion, because it's a moving and meaningful ritual, even without any historic or singular origin. Sounds pretty unusual to me, but I'm not going to lecture him about being wrong. I'm not going to have any conversation with him about right and wrong, for that matter. It's not a question of right and wrong. It's a question of making one's religious journey with integrity and humility, which means always nurturing your own open, compassionate heart. Samir writes, faith imagines, or if you prefer, confidence imagines. And so does doubt, he adds. We have both, and we are better together. Looking back all the way to my first time at a Unitarian Universalist church, or as we called it, a Universalist Unitarian church, which way is the right way of saying that? I can't think of a better way of describing why I showed up there in the first place and why I stayed. Because I want to keep on imagining justice and living out not a series of theological beliefs and assertions, but my deep and most compassionate values of compassion, kindness, and love. The love that's all that mattered in the first place.